Tonight we'll begin with Griffin versus Hartford Life. And Mr. Grabhorn.
Good morning, if it pleases the court. My name is Michael Grabhorn. I represent Scott Griffin, the plaintiff and appellant in this action. As the court is probably well aware, this is an ERISA action involving the termination of disability benefits under a single policy. It involved monthly income and also
can you pull that microphone? For
sure. Here. Is that better?
Yes, that's better. Okay. Thank you.
Involved, like I said, an ERISA long-term disability insurance policy as well as a life policy where disability benefits provided. In this case, at the instance where we're dealing with, where Mr. Griffin is unable to perform the essential duties of any occupation for which he's reasonably trained and educated. A quick history on the policy itself or the benefits. Mr. Griffin, resident of Lynchburg, Virginia, was employed by Immodal and covered by the plan. I believe he began disability benefits, which were approved by Hartford in 2012 on the long-term disability monthly income benefit on the basis of his inability to do his job duties at Immodal. 24 months, the benefits then changed in the definition to an any occupation definition, whereby, as I mentioned earlier, where we get into the essential duties test of whether or not he can currently perform the essential duties of any other occupation for which he reasonably trained and educated. During the same period of time, the life disability benefit under the same policy was being provided from the start through the termination in 2015, whereby he was unable to perform already. And been determined unable to perform the essential
plan
duties.
Documents give the administrative discretion.
Absolutely. And those are the issues really before the court today. The two issues that we've posited for appeal, because this is always significant to the resolution of an ERISA case. What is the standard of review? We have the Supreme Court in Glenn versus MetLife, which tells us that the standard of review, the default standard of review, is de novo. The court reviews the record and the evidence before the plan administrator at the time the decision was made, and makes a resolution or a decision of its own accord without any deference to the plan administrator. Or alternatively, if the plan provides the discretionary language, which Glenn does not really enunciate what satisfies that, and we don't need to get into that, we've already stipulated and agreed that the language in the policy would do that. There is discretionary language in the insurance policy. That's not in dispute. But there's a second part of that test, which has been fleshed out and being fleshed out across the circuits right now, is that just because you have the language doesn't mean you have automatic, arbitrary, and capricious review. You have to have someone who is a fiduciary exercise that discretion. In this instance, we posit that Hartford Life and Accident Insurance Company, who we've now learned in other litigation as well as here, has no employees. It cannot possibly make a decision. What has it done? It has done what a number of other insurance companies do that are in the insurance market from a cost standpoint. They hire a third party, in this case, Hartford Fire, which is a separate legal entity within the chain of the Hartford financial groups and so on. We laid out a chart, I believe, on that in the briefing, to do the administration. The people that made the decision here, they've admitted that they were the sole responsibility, sole responsibility for making the decision.
I think you have a lot better arguments to make than this one, I can tell you. The policy issued by Hartford Accident, the claim was made to Hartford Accident. Every letter sent to your client came from Hartford Accident. The decision was on a document from Hartford Accident. These people who signed on behalf of Hartford Accident were paid by Hartford Fire, but that's not evident from in the handling of the claims, and it's probably a borrowed agency type arrangement that is fairly common. But the idea that this was not the decision of Hartford Accident was belied by the record 100%.
With due respect, Judge, I would disagree on the facts here, because one, I think what's happened here is that Mr. Griffin did not bear the burden of proof on this issue.
No, and he got a letter from Hartford Accident every time. It's a Hartford Act signed by Hartford Accident, and every decision was made by Hartford Accident. The denials were, the appeals were. You can keep arguing that I'm going to.
I'm a dead horse. I understand.
Let me turn your attention to the other issue: is of the adequacy of this review. It's a low bar, but it's not an absence of review. let me make sure I understand the facts here. For 3 years, the appellant received benefits. The last, and in March of 2014, it was determined in the more rigorous any occupation standard, it was determined the medical record supported disability. Is that not correct?
Yes, Judge.
And part of that record was a report from the treating physician, Dr. Carmouche, a board-certified orthopedist, that the insured had severe spine degeneration, entire lumbar spine, and was looking at massive surgery involving rods and pedicle screws from the mid-spine to the lower back. Am I right about that?
Yes, Judge.
And based upon that, insured was awarded full benefits. But within 6 months, that's all turned around after 3 years of review. What was the new evidence after March of 2014?
We would say there's none. And I know this has been in the briefing, the parties addressed the change, what we call a change in condition over time, because as the Supreme Court said in Glenn, the insurance companies, even though they get the deferential review on the arbitrary capricious standard, they're held to a higher fiduciary duty here when they're doing these analyses. And Judge Moon, when we did oral argument on this, asked me as far as the shifting of burden. And no, there's not a shifting of burden here. But what there is, it operates as almost an estoppel, some sort of reliance with respect to the participant, in that you can't suddenly take all the evidence and have a different outcome 6 months later with nothing has changed.
Well,
and I would posit an answer to you.
Mistake, but the different difficulty here is when you dig into the record, and this is a hard record review, it's the way it's printed, it's very hard to follow, but I did. And it's very clear the medical case manager says the patient, the insured is disabled, can't sit for a long time. They go and try to get a second opinion. That second opinion, the guy says, I can't say he can work. I defer to the treating physician. And then they award benefits, and then 6 months later, which I can't see anything else in the record, suddenly what was good enough then is no longer explainable, and they're taking information that existed before that was apparently completely unpersuasive, and they're using that as an excuse now to take the man's benefits away after 3 years.
Yes, Judge. The thing that I think will be cited to, or at least it was in the letter, and Hartford has abandoned it in litigation, was the surveillance. They conducted, I think it was 4 days of surveillance and had less than 2 hours of activity where he had to go to the store and get groceries, pick, I believe, his son up from school and that sort of thing.
It's not even in the record. The video we checked, it's not even, the Forest Service doesn't even have it.
I understand. And we pointed that out as well, that it's a deficient record. And that's one of the reasons why when we were before Judge Boone, because Mr. Griffin was pro se. He was unrepresented, as a lot of individuals are, during the claims and appeals process. And they don't know, check the I's, dot the I's, sort of thing, whether or not to push them to get him a copy of that so he'd actually see it versus the written document itself, summary.
Is there anything wrong with the surveillance? Are you contesting the company's right to make a surveillance?
Oh, I don't think there's anything wrong with doing surveillance in and of itself, Judge. But what I do think is that surveillance, it can be helpful in certain instances, obviously, depending on what the underlying condition is. But I don't think you can use it to undermine medical. It didn't show anything. It showed him doing activities of life. Now, bear in mind, the definition here. And Judge Gergel, as you already pointed out, not only did they already find...
Did the surveillance show that he was picking up his child at school and shopping and the like?
It showed, I believe, that he went to the grocery or went to the store. He picked his son up at school, absolutely. But the definition of disability here, how did that translate? Their own doctor said it. And, in fact, in the transcript, and I can pull the transcript, Hartford has said we're not relying on that.
We're in the phase of the policy which requires that the plaintiff be unsuited for any occupation.
Yes, it's during the any occupation definition. The definition of this policy says that he has to be able to perform the essential duties. The inability to perform one or more of the essential duties means that he remains disabled, just as he had for 30 months under the life waiver premium definition, as well as for the prior 6 months under the long-term disability definition George Gergel mentioned.
It's a pretty broad definition.
Oh, sure it is. Now, the problem is...
You can't form the essential task of any occupation.
The essential...
How long did they actually afford him disability benefits, long-term disability?
They paid him long-term disability benefits for roughly, I want to say, about 30 months.
About 30 months.
Which means that he also had to have satisfied, I don't remember if it was a 90-day or six-month waiting period for short-term disability benefits. And so when we add those all together, roughly about 3 years of benefits were provided for disability.
But the definition changed from present occupation in March of 2014. It went to any occupation, the more demanding, broader, any occupation. But Hartford wrote a letter and said, you meet that qualification for disability.
Yes, they met the letter, and then the record does show, and we've cited it repeatedly in the briefing, where internally they recognized this supports ongoing disability under the any occupation standard. And then, but for that, nothing changed.
If someone's condition changes during the period of long-term disability, or there's new evidence that comes to light, is the company precluded from terminating benefits?
No, I wouldn't take that position, Judge. I mean, things can happen over time. Someone can have a condition that resolves itself. That's you know, that's not what we're positing. What we're saying is nothing changed.
Well, that's what was my question is, and Jeff Wilkinson is absolutely right. You could have a situation where the condition improved and the company is completely within its rights to reconsider. But I couldn't find anything that changed.
And I would agree, Judge.
Well, now, there was an interview with him. Who was the interview conducted by?
This was conducted by one of the Hartford Fire employees, I believe, where they come out and they'll sit someone down and ask them a bunch of questions about their education, how are they feeling, what are they doing on a daily basis.
And they were making the argument that as a result of the interview, he said that he hadn't seen a doctor for a year.
He couldn't afford it, Judge.
And that he was only intermittently taking any medication?
Right. He's treating for chronic pain. The problem is income. This is not a highly paid individual, as the record reflects. And he has no health insurance. And unfortunately, in this day and age, this is an economic reality that if you cannot pay for treatment, you don't get it.
In fact, their reference is to the fact that he wants further evaluation but cannot afford to get it.
Yes, yes, and that is in the record, Judge. That was addressed in the record, that he told them, look, I would go. Now, on the day of the interview, Judge Wilkinson, as you asked about whether Keeman asked him, he told them that he had taken, I don't remember if it was the muscle relaxant that particular day, the little bit that he had because of what he was going to do with that interview. He takes it as need be. Now, on a public policy standpoint, we already have the opioid issue going on. This man is very concerned about becoming addicted to these things. He doesn't want to go down that path. He takes the pain medication as he needs. Now, if he's in a more rigorous environment, in a work environment, that's going to escalate those things. One of the primary treatments for people that are dealing with chronic pain, radiculopathies, and so on, of spinal issues, is minimal activity, whether it's sitting, trying to avoid lengthy sitting and that sort of thing, standing, walking, whatever the case may be.
Consider the fact that he was denied benefits by the Social Security Administration?
No, you are not, Judge. And the reason why, to give you that short court answer, is it wasn't part of the record during the administrative process. One of the suggestions I had represented to Judge Moon, I think that should happen here.
Part of the record, would it be relevant?
Maybe. What we would have to do is pull the actual Social Security record, which Hartford had a release to get. I'm sorry?
It would not seem to be a difficult thing to pin down. Whether someone is denied Social Security disability benefits...
It's in the record, I believe.
...would not seem...
Well, yeah, the denial itself is in, but the basis for it is not. And I believe he's... And I don't do Social Security. I don't represent him on that. I believe he's still pursuing it, but ultimately it's not in the record. If Hartford made it,
the fact that he was denied benefits in the record?
I want to say it was in the claim file. Yes, was it other than the other than the one sentence that they referenced in the claim letter? I don't believe they provided any other explanation of why.
I mean, if he could not. any job in the economy, he certainly would have gotten Social Security benefits, wouldn't he?
I can't answer that, Judge. What I can tell you is, what I can tell you is, though, to an extent, I would have to defer to anybody that does Social Security. I don't, but I do know this, Judge. Social Security has a complete, distinct, different definition of disability than this insurance policy at issue, which is the contractual relationship between the parties. And Himeshoff,
this is a. I'm worried about the fact that if we pull the administrator up short here on the grounds that, well, you granted him long-term disability, now what's changed? What you're going to do is you're going to push administrators in the position of saying, well, we shouldn't do this. We shouldn't grant them disability benefits in the first place because the courts will use that against us in saying, well, what's changed? And so you create an incentive not to do what Hartford did, which was to grant long-term disability. If any time you seek to terminate that status, the courts are going to hold that against you and whack you and say, look, once you're granted long-term disability, that's got to be a semi-permanent status. I worry about that. Now, sometimes these things have unintended consequences, and the unintended consequence here might be that companies are more reluctant to put beneficiaries on long-term disability initially.
I'm out of time, Judge.
Okay, well, think about it a little bit.
I'll see you in a little bit. I'll see you in a little bit, Judge. Thank you.
Opposing counsel. Mr. Neiman.
Thank you, Judge Wilkinson. May it please the court. My name is John Nyman. I'm here from Alabama representing Hartford. Judge Moon's decision correctly assessed the realities that underlie both the right rule with respect to the standard of review and the right ruling on the merits in this case. From the court's comments during my colleague's opening argument, it sounds like that we'd be better served by addressing the realities that underlie the second question on the merits, but suffice it to say that the decision that my client, Hartford Life and Accident Insurance Company, was in fact the entity.
Just tell us why you think it was not an abusive, why it was a permissible exercise of discretion to terminate that.
That's sure, Your Honor. The reality that justified fully Judge Moon's decision on that front was the fact that this very important, undoubtedly important benefit that many of us receive through our employers is, in fact, a deal between the employee and the insurance company. Both sides have responsibilities, but that means that the employee has certain responsibilities as well. Disability insurance is not a we'll take you at your word kind of proposition. An employee always has the responsibility to establish through medical evidence that they are, in fact, unable to work and therefore in need of a check to offset their inability to work. That meant that when Mr. Griffin first claimed to be disabled and unable to work and needing that check, he couldn't just say, hey, Hartford, I am disabled. Trust me on this. Start sending me the check. He instead had to come forward with medical evidence that established that he was unable to work. And he did exactly that. He had doctors who explained that in 2012 he was unable to work full-time. The doctors expressly said they would not approve of him working at that time in 2012 more than 2 hours a day.
Your view is that the medical opinions changed.
As of 2014, when Hartford made the decision to terminate his ongoing disability benefit, Mr. Griffin could not and did not provide any doctor's statement that he had similar restrictions and limitations at that time.
Let me understand this. In March of 2014, Hartford granted full disability benefits in the more rigorous any occupation standard, correct?
That's correct, Judge Girdle.
And it recognized at that time that Dr. Carmouche, the treating orthopedic surgeon, the spine surgeon, had given the opinion that under no circumstances could this man handle sedentary work, even part-time. That's in your record, is it not?
I think I disagree slightly, Judge Gergel, with the characterization of what Hartford's conclusion was. Hartford,
it's actually in the record. Would you like me to refer to it for you? Where it actually says the attending physician says he cannot work even part-time.
So that comment resulted from communications between the peer reviewer, Dr. Teichman, and Dr. Carmouche, where Carmouche communicated based on the circumstances that followed Mr. Griffin's surgery in 2013, he could not recommend restrictions and or he could not recommend that he go back to work at that time. But at that time, the peer reviewer said, based on Carmouche's own statements, initially the peer reviewer said, I can't come up with my own restrictions and limitations. I don't have the information.
He could give an opinion that he could work. Then your examiner went back to him and tried to get him to change his opinion. Isn't that right?
I disagree with that characterization of
the fact. Refer to page 306 of the record. And the examiner then says, we have nothing if we can't get him to change his opinion.
But Judge Gergel, I think I understand the examiner in that circumstance to be saying, we've got Dr. Teichman's statement that he can't provide us anything one way or the other.
Actually, when you asked him to give a second statement, he then said, before he had no opinion, he said, you want an opinion? He's disabled. That's what Dr. Teichman said.
Right. So,
and then your group granted him full benefits. And then 6 months later, after going through all that where you couldn't get a second opinion contrary, suddenly his benefits are discontinued. What happened between March and September of 2014?
So initially what happened, various things happened, Judge Gergel. But,
one, two, three.
Sure.
Tell me what happened.
Let him have an opportunity to get his case out.
Sure. First of all, there was the interview in May of 2014. And that interview revealed a couple of things. One was that as of May 2014, Mr. Griffin had not seen any doctor in 2014 itself. It also revealed, as the opening argument suggested, that Mr. Griffin was spacing out his medications such that the last time he had had a prescription filled was in 2013. So you're talking about somebody who claims to be unable to work and to be fully disabled, but also not taking any medications throughout a five-month period.
Counsel indicated he couldn't afford the medication. Is that the reason he was taking them only intermittently or to avoid an addiction?
I'm not sure that the record definitively reveals why he was not taking the medications regularly. It may well be, as counsel suggested, that Mr. Griffin thought that it was inappropriate for him to take those medications. It certainly is the case that Mr. Griffin suggested that he wasn't seeing doctors because he couldn't afford to see the doctors. No doubt about that. I suspect that even though the claim denial in this case by Hartford did not rely on the Social Security denial, the fact that Mr. Griffin was not seeing doctors may well spring from the Social Security denial. But from Hartford's perspective, that means that the employee was not fulfilling his obligations under the policy in terms of going regularly to doctors who would say that at the time in question, this patient was unable to work because of medical evidence and had no restrictions.
Your view is that an administrator can periodically request an update from treating physicians and others as to what the present status of the individual were. Now, let me see if I understand your argument. Your argument was that they were willing initially at the time he went on disability to give a definitive statement, but as time went on, he was unable to produce a statement to the effect of he continues to be on disability and continues to be unable to work. In other words, the definitive statement that was the basis of the award earlier was not provided later.
That's exactly right. And in fact, he saw doctors in the statements that Hartford received from doctors that related to his condition in 2014 did not provide any restrictions or limitations at all. The last statement, Judge Gergel, that Hartford received from Dr. Carmouche said that Dr. Carmouche would not release Mr. Griffin to work until Dr. Brava had released Mr. Griffin to work. So then Hartford contacts Dr. Bravo, and Dr. Bravo says, I'm not placing any restrictions and limitations on Mr. Griffin because I saw him once in 2013, so that there are no restrictions there.
But I thought after that that Dr. Teichman went in 2014 to Dr. Carmouche, got him on the telephone, a 7:30 p.m. telephone conversation, and Dr. Carmouche says the man cannot work, 2014. He's not able to afford to go back to Carmouche because he doesn't have any money. But they get him on the telephone, and then Dr. Teichman writes a letter to Hartford and says that Dr. Carmouche notes the patient has significant degenerative pathology, page 756, and that he says, I'm forced to defer to the treating physician who says he cannot work. Isn't that right?
As of that time, that's what the peer reviewer says. But in the intervening time, Hartford learns that first of all, Mr. Griffin is not seeing doctors, not taking medications, but they also get indications both from Dr. Bravo and then Dr. McLaughlin, the chiropractor, suggesting that they, even though McLaughlin has seen Mr. Griffin during this time, that McLaughlin cannot impose restrictions and limitations.
Actually, the chiropractor wrote you back and said you misunderstood. I didn't put him on restrictions because he wasn't working. He said you have misunderstood my response to that question. That's right in the record.
I know which letter and phone call you're referring to, yes. Judge Gergel, but I disagree with the ultimate characterization of what Dr. McLaughlin was saying there. Initially, Dr. McLaughlin assigns this letter that's at JA 282, that's not the letter. It's at JA 665, a letter in August of 2014 where he's asked, are you placing restrictions on Mr. Griffin, and he checks off the box for no. But then there's a box afterwards that he's not supposed to check off if he's checked off no on the first question. It says, if you answered yes to the first question, explain why. And he answers that question and says, if you answered yes to that question, is there any reason why he can't go? I'm forgetting the exact nature of the question, but it says something along the lines. It's asking whether there's any reason why he can't go back to work. And there McLaughlin explains that he saw him in 2012, and based on his evaluation of him in 2012, he wasn't fit to go back to work at that point in time.
Right. But then he wrote a letter on September 23rd, 2014, 605 of the appellate record. He says, I think Mr. Griffin is being honest about his pain and discomfort. He's going to require surgery. I think he will have some disability afterwards, and that I have been misunderstood, that I didn't put him on restrictions because he wasn't working. That's page 605. He then had a follow-up phone call and said, you need to go back to Dr. Carmouche and talk to him. I'm a chiropractor. I mean, that's what Hartford's relying on?
So, yes, there's a follow-up call on JA 272 where Hartford calls, this is during the appeals process in September, not the initial claims denial in August. So during this appeals process, a letter is received from Dr. McLaughlin where he says the things that you have said, Judge Gergel. During the follow-up phone call, Dr. McLaughlin explains, I'm basing those comments on the self-report by Mr. Griffin. I'm not basing that on...
Oh, why was it so difficult to get a clear-cut statement on one sort or another at the time of termination? I mean, this seems to be fuzzy and ambiguous and all the rest.
Well, and doctors, all the relevant doctors were contacted, including Dr. Carmouche, Judge Gergel, and Carmouche just simply did not respond.
But he did take the telephone call from Dr. Teichman and did give a full report orally.
In March of 2014, but not in August of 2014. And you have statements from doctors such as Carmouche, I believe it's Carmouche at one point in time, who says that Mr. Griffin probably can do more than he thinks he can, either Dr. Carmouche thinks he can or that Mr. Griffin thinks he can. Ultimately, it's up to Mr. Griffin to provide that medical evidence. It's 6 months later, but saying that...
repeatedly that I'm not in a position to assess functionality. That's not my role. Would not assess the functionality for purposes of working.
Yes, Dr. Carmouche repeatedly refused to respond to Hartford's requests. And to the extent that there's a suggestion that Mr. Griffin should...
not even his business.
And to the extent there's a suggestion that a functional capacity evaluation should have been performed, that's Griffin's end of the bargain with respect to the disability insurance policy. Disability insurance is not health care or is not health insurance. It's not up to the disability insurer to send a doctor to perform a functional capacity evaluation or otherwise. That's something that Mr. Griffin had to do.
What Dr. Carmouche said was, that's not my discipline. I'm not an occupational therapist. I'm an orthopedic surgeon, and I can tell you, based on this severe spine degeneration, this man cannot sustain work. That's what he told you, right?
That's what he told Dr. Teichman based on his the last time he had seen Mr. Griffin, I believe, had been in 2012. That's what he tells, or excuse me, 2013. That's what he tells Dr. Teichman in early 2014. But this is 6 months later, and the mere fact that Hartford gave Mr. Griffin the benefit of the doubt and did the right thing in terms of exercising caution in early 2014 does not mean that Mr. Griffin is entitled to a disability check for the rest of his life. He's got an obligation to come forward with evidence and to rule otherwise, as Mr. Griffin wants the court to do, would mean effectively a company like Hartford would be punished for not conducting all of this analysis that it ended up conducting in May and June and August of 2014. In early March, and thus denying disability benefits earlier.
So how often do you, when you have someone on long-term disability, how often do you, does this come up for review as to whether the individual is still in prevented from, as I say, we have this very broad standard from performing the essential task of any occupation. But how often is that status determination of long-term disability reviewed? Every 3 months, every 6 months? How often?
So, Judge Wilkinson, the record suggests that there is something called a milestone call that is made every 3 months or so, and you see those calls made at least early on in the process. In this very long document you've got in Volume 2 of the JA, from JA 268 to 379. It looks like every 3 months or so, Hartford would make calls to Mr. Griffin and ask him, you know, what the status of his disability was and his ability to work was. It's telling, I think, that there are several calls that Hartford made to Mr. Griffin where Mr. Griffin responded effectively, do I have to keep on taking these calls? I don't want you to, I feel like I shouldn't have to establish that I'm disabled continually. And Hartford explained to him that
my concern here is that if we transform long-term disability into some form of semi-entitlement, once you first get on, that companies are going to be really reluctant to put people on, because then they're going to be charged with having made an enduring decision, even in the face of a change of status. So, what what may seem the empathetic thing to do can boomerang badly in terms of making companies very reluctant to put someone on long-term disability. I'm not sure that's the direction we want to go. Is this a danger?
I think it certainly is a danger. If the ruling is that based on the fact that Hartford was somewhat unsure about his status in March of 2014 and went ahead and continued his benefits for a few months while it did more investigation, Griffin provided no further evidence of his disability. I think in that circumstance, all the incentives would be for Hartford to deny benefits as of March 2014, to say he can't satisfy any occupation definition that came into play in March of 2014. At the end of the day, people in Mr. Griffin's shoes would face terminations, or at least incentives for the companies to terminate earlier than they did here.
But how could you possibly have turned down long-term benefits in March of 2014 when you had the treating physician saying unqualifiedly he can't do the work, and your own second opinion agreed with it? I mean, there wasn't really a lot of imagination it took, and that's why I keep asking you, what was the new evidence? Because you have this MRI that is just devastating about how bad his back is. That doesn't change. And you have what we don't have is that this man does not have the money to go back to a doctor to keep getting opinions. And for that, he can lose his benefits?
Well, so what changes, I think, as of between March of 2014 and September of 2014 is the fact that Hartford gets all this new information that he is – Judge Gergel, that he's not, excuse me for interrupting.
Go right ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you, sir.
He's not seeing doctors. The hope is, with respect to anybody who gets put on disability, that eventually they get better. And it cannot be the case that the company has to presume that anybody they put on disability will be on disability for the rest of their life. Given that that's the arrangement that employees enter into with these companies, the arrangement also has to be that the employee has an ongoing obligation to see doctors, to take medications if they're going to help them get better, and to do things like PT to get better. So it was entirely appropriate for Hartford to say to Mr. Griffin, you've got to keep seeing doctors, and if you cannot get a doctor who will tell you that you are currently restricted and limited, that you cannot work any occupation currently, then you're no longer entitled to maintain your status under the policy.
Between March and September of 2014, when did the actual surveillance take place?
The surveillance, I believe, took place. It took place before his interview in May. I believe it was either May or no, it was earlier than May. It was March 27 and 28, and then there was surveillance on April 16 and 17 as well.
So, what significance do you attach to that?
We haven't abandoned it, as Mr. Griffin's attorney suggested, but I do suggest that it's not a substantial factor in the analysis. I mean, it did not show that he was unable to move around. So to that extent, it was somewhat
able to move around. He told y'all he was driving.
Right.
Everything he did was consistent with what he had told Hartford.
Right. But other than that, it's not as if Hartford said this surveillance definitively shows that he's able to work 8 hours a day.
No, I was going to direct my question at that, whether the Hartford is allowed to consider the observations of his mobility, going upstairs, sitting in an interview for an hour, standing just once just to stretch out, moving his hands and arms, seeing him in the surveillance that he gets around without any kind of limp or hesitation, gets in and out of the truck, goes in shop, picks up a kid. These are observations. And then you have Kamush's statement that I'm not sure this man can't do more than what he says he's doing. These suspicions sort of seem to me would justify a demand for a better evidence that he's disabled. All these are indicative he can do something, because there are just many, many jobs where you can get up and down and you can adjust and sit at a desk and that type of thing.
Agreed, Judge Niemeyer. The other thing that's revealed during the interview is the fact that he's driving an hour and a half with one stop during the to take certain appointments.
My question is how you sort of discounted that a little bit. I'm wondering, is Hartford allowed to take those facts into observation, or is it limited to these statements that are being made by various doctors about his condition?
No, it absolutely is allowed to consider those things. They are a factor in the abuse of discretion analysis, but especially since Judge Gergel, one thing that happened in the interchange between Teichman and Carmouche was that Teichman said to Carmouche, well, what about modifying his work such that he stands up during part of the day or moves around during part of the day, and Carmouche declined to opine on that issue. So
he didn't change his opinion. He said he can't do the work even part-time.
He declined to opine on what would happen if modifications occurred, and given what Hartford saw during the interview and otherwise, Hartford's decision here was correct, but at the very least was no abuse of discretion. Thank you.
We'd like to hear from you in rebuttal, sir.
Judge Wilkinson, you made a long statement to me right before we wrapped up my initial argument to the court, and I wanted to come back and hit on that, and also a phrase that I think you used or expressed a concern on counsel's argument, and that was the phrase semi-entitlement. And I want to be clear here. In no manner, shape, or form am I advocating for that sort of analysis. What I am advocating for is that where an ERISA fiduciary makes a decision, if it's going to change that decision, reverse itself, it has to have some new justification to explain that. ERISA is supposed to be a higher standard.
Is that too mechanical? It seems to me he gets disability benefits to replace his income if he can't work. And any job for which he has education and so forth qualifies him. Here, this man had an operation. Carmouche, in 2013, Carmouche gives an opinion that as of that time, he didn't see him after that, that he couldn't work. But he also says he believed the guy could do more than he thinks he can do. And he also said, I'm not a functionality type of guy. So the disability carrier says, we'll give you disability benefits until we can fully explore this. They conduct surveillance. They do an interview. They continue to call the doctors. They give them an appeal. And nothing comes forward to say, why can't this man sit at a desk or get up and down for some of these various jobs? And the fact of the matter is people do get, health does improve. The body has a self-healing. It may not get totally better. So it seems to me the carrier can, from time to time, check, are you still having troubles, with the expectation maybe things are getting better. That's, I don't know if you call that a change or not, but you can't assume that the condition that somebody has after an operation in 2013 is going to last for the rest of his life. So the question is, it's not a change, it's just a generalized improvement in healing from disabilities. And so the burden is on the beneficiary to demonstrate that he can't work and he's going to get this benefit. And he sort of got irritated at being asked that question.
Well, in a roundabout response, Judge, folks get aggravated all the time for all sorts of reasons.
No, that's not the reason.
But I understand. But coming back to the issue, I'm not trying to say that they can't. They have an ongoing duty every month or however frequency. I think one of the judges asked how often does Hartford do it, and I believe typically they start out every month, then it's every 3 months, then it's once a year in what's called a SAM unit.
Arguing for some notion that there's a gotcha. In other words, once Hartford says we're going to give you benefits, there has to be some dramatic change before they can reverse that. And my suggestion is they, in in a moment when they didn't have the full information, they're giving them the benefit of the doubt and investigating. They didn't make their conclusion in March until, what, August, when they made their first conclusion?
Well, I would disagree, because internally...
When did they make their decision?
They did it shortly after Teichman. All the internal notes and everything indicate...
What month is that?
I want to say it was March. Don't hold me to that exact. I want to say it was either March. It was right after
that
the heart.
That doesn't make sense.
Attachment.
They conducted the interview after that. They did the surveillance.
Right. They did. Well, going to your question, Judge. Though there is an ongoing.
High benefits. It's August, right?
That when they terminated his benefits was right around August. Right after the surveillance and after the impersonal interview. Now, what I will tell you, because it goes back to the question, what additional medical evidence did they have that changed? They didn't have anything new from Teichman, because on the appeal, despite the claim regulations requiring them to go and get a medical professional, they didn't.
Doesn't that shift the burden?
I don't know that it's a burden shifting as far as when we're under A and C, but it is indicative of a failure to file.
So what you're saying is that once you go on disability, then the burden shifts to the administrator to prove that there's been no improvement?
No, Judge. I'm not advocating.
But it sounds...
No, what I'm
having a presumption of continuing disability, that would be one way to phrase it, or another way to phrase it would be that this is a burden shifting scheme and the burden shifts to the administrator to prove continuing disability once long term disability is awarded.
I think it kind of creates an estoppel position, not a burden issue. So by way of example, if all three of you decided
that can't be the law. That cannot be the law.
What's that?
You can't be stopped, but the more important issue is there evidence afterwards that he was getting better or that his condition changed? But there can't be that the carrier is stopped.
No. When I say a stop, what I'm doing is from the fiduciary standpoint. My time's out if I can complete here, Judge. And that is this, that once you make a decision, if Hartford said my eyes are blue, they made an investigation and said my eyes are blue, and 6 months later they come back to me and say, no, your eyes are brown. With nothing changing in between, the position here is that if a fiduciary,
it's a burden of an analogy. I mean, somebody has a hip operation, and they're in the hospital for a period of time. Then
right.
They can't work. They're out, totally out. They're lying down. They're trying to get improved. 6 months later, they're totally better. Now, there's no. The idea is that operations are designed to make people better, and you call to find out, is he getting better?
Right. There's nothing problem. I have no issue with investigation, Judge.
Except, but that's what Kamush is saying.
Kamush said that way back.
Had 2013.
Right.
Spoke in March of 2014, had not seen him.
Mm-hmm.
And did say, based on 2013, sure he's disabled because he just had an operation. But he had not seen him in March. And so now they go ahead and do surveillance, and they go and interview him, and they keep calling for functionality. They go see a doctor. They entreat him somehow to demonstrate that he can't work. And every indication suggests that he could do something. I mean, this is these observations. And I don't know if you suggest otherwise. I'd like to know what evidence after March suggests that he couldn't work.
Oh, you have McLaughlin's opinion, Judge.
Let me ask you one question here.
Yes.
If the let's suppose that the plaintiff's condition undergoes a deterioration, and that the doctors have expressed to him a willingness to provide a definitive statement that he's not suited for performing the essential task of any occupation, could he then reapply to the company for a resumption or a return to long-term disability? In other words, I wonder if this is not a fluid process, and if he at some point in the future found physicians who were willing to give an updated statement that conformed to that matched the terms of the policy, whether there'd be a chance that the long-term disability benefits would resume?
Under this policy, Judge, I don't believe so, because he would have to become an employee again and remain covered under this policy. And he's no longer an active employee. It hasn't been since 2012.
But is there any legal bar to resumption, such as a break in employment or what?
Without doing the detailed analysis, my gut's going to tell me that the contract's going to say once you're no longer covered, you're no longer covered. And so at the end of this disability, if there was a break of 6 months or whatnot, and he gets picked some
but
disease.
But that's a hunch.
Yes, I can't tell you definitively. And a lot of this, all goes back to even Judge Moon speculate. A lot of this we're talking about here is speculation. This is why ERISA requires, look, let's have a full and open dialogue during the claims process, especially when these folks are unrepresented. And that's why I would posit that to get the answers to the majority of the questions this court has, that a remand would have been warranted at the very least.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, judges. Thank you for the time.
I'm down in Greek Council and move into our next case.